and he found a contractor via Craigslist. He didn't vet him through any channels he trusted, and he didn't find him via a referral. In essence, Brandon was trusting this person to be a man of his word. Once they agreed on the work, Brandon sent the $5,000 to the contractor to buy the materials and do the work. When he called back to check in on him, he stopped answering his phone. Later, it was confirmed that the contractor was gone and the work was not done. So, Brandon had a lien placed against this individual he had paid who didn't do the work. This was a court judgment issued by a judge who heard the case and determined that Brandon was damaged in the relationship. The cool news is, a few years later, this shady contractor sold his home. Because there was a lien issued against him, the title company withheld the money for the amount of the lien, and Brandon got paid back. In the end, Brandon got his money and ended up with a cool story to share for all of us to learn from. Stories like this are why I like to use people who have been referred to me by others I trust. I can't guarantee nothing will ever go wrong, but the odds are much, much higher in my favor when someone else has already vetted this Core 4 member and has good experience with them. Another way we can learn from this story is to consider buying the materials ourselves the first time we work with a contractor. This is a really simple tweak to put into the system and can save you money in the end. Ask them to separate the materials from the labor. This way you can see what you'll be paying for labor only. Then, ask the contractor to call the store where they'll be buying things from and put in the order. Once the order has been placed, you will call and pay for the order over the phone. Then, either have the materials shipped to the property where the contractor will receive them, or have the contractor go pick the items up themselves. This way, you solve two potential problems. One, you don't have to worry about the contractor overcharging you for materials. Two, you don't have to worry about the contractor stealing the money that would have been used for materials. Doing things this way can also give you the opportunity to find materials on sale or build up your credit card points. I recommend doing this for the first few jobs with a new contractor until you get a better feel for their character and build up trust. Key points. Add square footage to increase value. Add bedrooms and bathrooms to increase value. Use cheap labor, not skilled, when the opportunity presents itself. Use mulch to cover eyesores in a yard on a resale. Think long-term and durable when choosing flooring on a fixer-upper. Replace roofs before the refinance to recover a big chunk of your investment. Never pay a contractor for the entire job up front. Pay for materials yourself the first time you use a contractor to be sure you aren't overpaying. Part 4. The Rental Process. Chapter 6. Understanding Rent Prices. Money is a terrible master, but an excellent servant. P.T. Barnum. Once you've bought and successfully rehabbed your property, the worst is over. Now all you need to do is find a tenant for it, refinance it, and buy the next one. Intelligent investors don't buy a property hoping it will cash flow. They have run these numbers long before they closed on the property, and probably before they even wrote an offer. This gives them a really good chance of knowing what they are in for before it's too late to back out. Calculating cash flow is pretty easy. We went over that in the beginning of the book. In this chapter, we are going to discuss how to estimate what your rents are likely to be, what we can do to increase them, and how to determine if they are likely to continue to rise. For the vast majority of the investment property you will ever purchase, the only form of income you will receive will be your rents. This means that getting your rent numbers right and buying in areas likely to see an increase in rent is paramount to the performance of your property and your success as an investor. There are numerous variables that affect the rent you receive for a property, both now and in the future. Learning how to read these variables and anticipate them when possible will lead to a huge compound effect on your wealth. If you choose the right area to invest in and rents continue to increase every year, you're virtually guaranteed to make money in real estate investing. If you choose the wrong area and things go badly, it can be incredibly difficult to avoid losing money. Remember, rents are the only form of income your property can generate. This isn't a business where you can change to a new product if the current one isn't selling. We are putting all the marbles on the rent supporting the property. It's vital to make sure we understand how to do this correctly. In order to be as efficient as possible, I've broken the process down into two parts: preliminary rent estimates and more accurate rent estimates. Finding preliminary rent estimates. When you're first analyzing a property, it's often not sensible to dig in and put in serious due diligence to find an exact rent number. At this stage, the process for finding rents is very similar to that of finding the ARV when you're looking at comps. We don't need something exact. We just need to find something that lets us know if we are even in the ballpark. In my experience, the more accurate the information you receive is, the more time it takes to find it. This is why real estate investing due diligence is typically done in chunks, as opposed to all the work up front on every deal. Consider an old gold prospector. Did he put his nose in the dirt and look for flashes of gold in the middle of the entire river? That would have taken forever. Instead, miners developed a process for sifting gold. They took big chunks of earth, shook it up through a filter, eliminated the big stuff, and then dug deeper into the materials that sifted through. This is the same way we want to approach real estate investing. We start with very big numbers of properties, tons of options. We then use rules of thumb, like the 1% rule I mentioned at the beginning of the book, to filter most of those properties out. Of the ones remaining, we dig deeper, putting them through another filter, making sure they are able to be purchased below market value. Of the ones that are left, we do a preliminary rent estimate to see if they would cash flow. For those that do, we consider making an offer. If that offer is accepted, we look deeper into the rent numbers to get as accurate of a picture as we possibly can. This method is meant to save you time and help you filter through more deals. To get started, we need good systems or tools to help us determine what the rent is likely to be. The best tools are easy to use, quick, and accurate enough to trust for at least a preliminary number. Once you've figured out your system for establishing preliminary numbers, you'll find you can analyze property really quickly and move on to either digging in deeper or throwing it into the garbage heap. Rentometer.com. Much like a peanut butter and jelly sandwich, Rentometer.com is brilliant due to its simplicity. This is one of my favorite websites on the entire internet by far. Rentometer.com uses an algorithm that considers rental properties near the subject property and plugs their rent amounts into a secret formula. This formula then spits out the numbers we need for our preliminary rent analysis. When Rentometer.com gives you your result, it shows you four categories related to surrounding rents. 1. The average rent of surrounding units. 2. The median rent of surrounding units. 3. The rent spread 80% of the units will fall into. 4. The rent spread 60% of the units will fall into. I typically use the average rent, as the other numbers aren't as concerning to me, especially during this preliminary stage. At this point, I want the average rent to be at or near 1% of the sales price of the property, and I want to see the average rent is close to the median rent. If there is a huge disparity between the average and the median rent, that could be indicative of potential problems. If this is the case, you'll need to dig deeper into this property. Is it right on the fringe of a split between a good neighborhood and a bad one? Is it really close to a large apartment complex where rents are much lower and some of that complex's problems could be spilling over into your property's front yard? In general, you want data to be consistent. When we find inconsistencies, we need to dig deeper to understand why. Rentometer.com has another feature that makes this simple to do, and it's one of the reasons why I love this site. Not only does it display the average rents, but it also shows you which properties around yours are renting for which price. It's helpful to know what the average rent is, but it's imperative to be able to see the addresses of the properties and their specific rents. In order to use this feature, simply find the map directly below the numbers we just discussed and hover your cursor over the symbols on the map representing various properties. You'll notice these symbols are vertical lines coded in different colors. Red lines represent properties with significantly higher rent than yours. Yellow lines are properties with rent similar to yours, and green lines are for properties with a rent lower than yours. Because the properties are displayed on a map, you can see exactly where they lie and what part of town they are in. My favorite technique is to hover over another property and copy the web address that shows up when I click on the symbol. I then paste this address into Zillow.com, Trulia.com, or Realtor.com, and look at the condition and pictures of the property itself. If the property is similar in size and condition to mine, I know I have a reliable comparative to base my potential rent on. If the property is bigger or nicer than mine, I know my rent will likely be slightly lower. If my property is bigger, nicer, or in a better area, I know my rent will likely be higher. This is one of the fastest, easiest, and most reliable ways I've ever found to analyze the expected rent of a potential property I'm interested in. The whole process takes a matter of minutes, and even though it's only a preliminary step, I've found that it is just as accurate as the more detailed steps I take. Keep this website in your arsenal, and it will help you analyze deals much faster, especially when you compare it with the next tool. BiggerPockets.com Calculators. BiggerPockets has a feature you can find at BiggerPockets.com/calculators. That takes all the work of analyzing a deal and does it for you. Most of the work we need to do as investors involves finding the right numbers to plug into a formula. With the BiggerPockets calculator, you don't need to actually do the math. Just find the numbers, plug them in, and the analysis is done for you. BiggerPockets has several different calculators you can use depending on the type of project you're doing. They have calculators for flipping, wholesaling, cash flow, and yes, even BRRRR. These calculators are designed to prompt you to enter information such as the expected rent, vacancy, repairs, closing costs, etc. The whole analysis can be run for you in seconds and gives you vital information like your expected cash flow, ROI, etc. Having a tool like this at your disposal helps you in several ways. It not only takes away any issues you had with analyzing property because of a dislike for math, but it also makes a full and complete analysis of a property easy and fast. It also allows you to leverage off a lot of this work to someone else. It doesn't take much skill to plug numbers into something and click a button to get an analysis. Let's say you have found a property you want to buy for $120,000 that rents for $1,000 a month. You enter all the relevant information into the BiggerPockets calculator and find this property would provide you with an ROI of 7%. This won't work for you, and you want at least 10%. Seeing immediately this won't work, you go back to the data entry portion of the calculator and change the purchase price from $120,000 to $100,000. You run a new analysis. The new analysis shows at this new price, the ROI would be 11%. Bingo! You now know you can offer $100,000 to buy this property and the deal will work for you. You tell your agent to write the offer, and the seller counters at $105,000. Now that you know you're close, it would make sense to dive into the deeper analysis of the deal and do a more thorough check of the rent and rehab numbers to make sure they work. If they do, you accept the counter or counter yourself. This is how real estate is bought. It's not a decision made once and then a lot of hoping that everything works out. It's a series of small decisions made over and over, with each one revealing more information about the deal and you deciding if you like what you see. Knowing we'll be making numerous small decisions throughout a transaction, it doesn't make sense to try to do all the work for every decision at the very beginning. Breaking down this due diligence into several phases will make real estate investing more enjoyable and will make you more efficient with your time and work. Tools like Rentometer.com and BiggerPockets calculators will help streamline the process for you. Finding more accurate rent estimates. Once we've conducted our preliminary rent estimate analysis, we need to decide whether we'll be moving forward. This is oftentimes simply a matter of making an offer and seeing if it's accepted or not. If the offer is accepted, or if for some other reason you decide you want to move forward more aggressively on a property, you're going to want to do a much more accurate and time-intensive analysis of the property. The purpose of a preliminary rental estimate is to see if the property is worth purchasing. The point of a more accurate rent estimate is to determine what you can expect regarding the rent of a property if you end up purchasing it. Having accurate rent numbers is important because it helps us determine our ROI. You need to have an accurate assessment of your ROI so you can compare properties to each other and know which one is likely to bring you the best return. There are several ways to determine a more accurate idea of what to expect for rent. Below are some of the methods I've used most often that have led to accurate results without too much time invested. Asking other investors in the area. If you want to know what to expect, ask someone who's gone before you. This is good advice for real estate and good advice for anything else as well. Asking others who have already done what you're doing is a great way to skip a lot of the mistakes you'd inevitably make while shortening your learning curve. If you know another investor in the area where you're looking to buy, this is a great time to reach out and talk to them. Start by asking what kinds of properties the investor owns. You don't want to be asking a multifamily or commercial apartment investor about single-family houses or vice versa. If they own properties similar to what you want to buy, ask them which area they own in and make sure it is similar to where you're looking. If both of these questions yield positive answers, you found a potential resource. The first question I ask is for the addresses of the homes they own and the amount they are getting for rent. If they aren't comfortable giving you the full address or you aren't comfortable asking, ask for the street name. Most of the time, people are fine sharing that. Once you have these numbers, do a cross-reference on Rentometer.com and see if the rent they get is in line with market rents for the area. You may find rents have increased and Rentometer.com is not reflective of this yet. If you find the rent prices they receive are close to what Rentometer.com says, your work may be done. You can trust Rentometer.com and move forward to the purchase with a good idea of what your rents will be. If this isn't enough for you and you want even more due diligence to conduct, check out the next method. Asking property managers. Asking property managers is, in my opinion, the hands-down best way to get accurate numbers for potential rental property. The reason is simple. If they are good at their job, they work with renters every day looking for a rental property. This means they know what amenities tenants want, what they are willing to pay for them, which part of town they want to be in, etc. Property managers have the information you need when trying to make your decision on where to buy or what to expect in rent. The reason I don't go to them right away is because I don't want to burn my relationship with them by asking too many questions and taking up too much of their time and then not buying the property. Just like any other business relationship, it needs to be a two-way street. Too many newbie investors make this mistake and burn relationships with a potential serious business partner by asking for too much and not providing anything in return. I don't want this to happen to me, so I don't get PMs involved until I'm serious about moving forward. The system I have in place for getting information from my property managers is simple. I send them an email asking them 3 questions I want answered. If I've worked with the same PM for any significant period of time, all I have to do is send them the address and they know to answer these 3 questions for me. The questions are: 1. What rent can I expect for this property? 2. What do you think a rough idea of this property's ARV is? 3. Is this a neighborhood you want to manage in or not? The reason I ask question number 1 is pretty obvious. I ask question 2 because I'm looking to verify that the numbers my realtor, wholesaler, or other party gave me are accurate. It is always a good idea to get a second opinion, as long as that opinion is educated and relevant. Do you remember how I mentioned I prefer members of my core 4 to be investors themselves? This is one of my reasons why. If my property manager is also an investor, they are much more likely to know the value of the property, not just the market rents. If I have 1 more set of experienced eyeballs looking over my deal, I will feel more comfortable to pull the trigger and close, or back out because the numbers didn't add up. I ask the 3rd question because the first 2 don't tell the whole story. Investors often get into trouble because analyzing properties on paper can often lead to a false sense of security. If we are clever, we can make numbers say whatever we want them to say, and that isn't always a good thing. When analyzing a property, it's not just the rent we should consider. It's all the data. Rent is great, but if the property is in an area not conducive to real estate investing, the rent numbers are never going to look in real life what they appear to be on paper. There are lots of issues that can lead to your cash flow evaporating that won't show up on a typical online calculator or spreadsheet. Consider how badly even 1 eviction can hurt your cash flow. Or a tenant who trashes a house, requiring thousands of dollars invested to restore it. Consider that not every tenant will pay their rent on time or at all, and that sometimes tenants let entire families or groups of people move into your property in a way that violates your lease big time. Yes, the law will be on your side when this happens, but the government doesn't reimburse you for lost rent, expenses, or legal fees. Anytime this happens, the responsibility falls on you and your wallet to fix it. I tell my PMs to check and make sure the properties I send them are located in areas they don't mind managing. Here's a tip for you. If you're buying properties in rough neighborhoods, your property manager likely won't want to manage them either. By making it clear it's okay if they tell you this up front, you are much more likely to get an honest and transparent assessment of the neighborhood than if they feel pressured to tell you what you want to hear. This communication is crucial to you and your due diligence process. By checking with the property manager on both the expected rent, the value of the home, and the condition of the neighborhood, you are getting some very valuable and professional information to help you make the best decision possible. Before I buy anything, I run it by my PMs first to make sure they are on board and aren't seeing anything I'm missing. At the very least, you should be having this conversation to make sure they validate all the other due diligence you've done so far. Asking agents to provide rental comps from the MLS. Many investors don't know they can ask real estate agents to search the MLS for rental comparables. This isn't well known because in many areas, real estate agents don't also manage rental properties, so they don't specialize in this service. While I don't use agents to manage my properties, meaning I don't use people whose primary purpose is selling homes to manage mine, I do use agents from time to time to verify or validate information being provided to me by another party. Consider this. Your property manager tells you they expect the rent to be around $1,000 a month. You know from checking rentometer.com that you were thinking $1,200 sounded more accurate. You ask a real estate agent to check the surrounding comparable rentals and tell you what they are renting for. They come back and tell you most are somewhere between $1,200 and $1,400. This information would suggest that either something is very wrong with or different about the property you're thinking about buying, or your property manager is bad at their job at best and downright dishonest at worst. When you have this tool in your belt, you can feel a lot more confident that you aren't being taken advantage of and aren't relying on the wrong person's advice to collect the data you need to make an informed decision. How to determine if rents are likely to increase. As most of us understand from Economics 101, the price of an item is determined by two things, supply and demand. Real estate is no exception. Understanding the market and how rent prices are affected by it is mandatory if you want to be a black belt real estate investor. Just as ROI is determined by two numbers, yearly cash flow and the investment basis, home values are also determined by two factors, supply and demand. Learning what affects each of them in a given market will help you make the most intelligent decision regarding what to buy, how much of it to buy, and where. The good news is you don't have to be an economist to be able to understand market factors. Let me explain. Demand for areas is dependent on how many people want to move there. Supply for an area is determined by how many properties are available for people to move into. Pretty simple, right? I'm going to give you an overview of how to determine the demand for an area as well as how to determine if there is insufficient supply. Understanding these factors helps protect your investment from a decline in value, as does choosing areas that are likely to appreciate at a rate faster than the national average. Determining demand based on supply. Demand is simply the measurement for how badly someone wants something. In 1996, a toy was released that quickly became infamous for its ridiculous demand. Tickle Me Elmo became the toy of the year. Due to its short supply, prices skyrocketed as people fought to get their hands on one. Some people were selling theirs online for very high prices, sometimes several $1,000s, after buying them at the store for $30. This is an extreme example, but it highlights how demand works. When a lot of people want something, they will pay more for it. If supply is also low, they will pay exponentially more for it. If you look at most of the big runs in real estate value, they were the result of housing demand surpassing supply. If you look at the areas where prices have appreciated the fastest, they are the areas where people want to live the most. Factors that determine where to live. Employment opportunities. Employment is becoming more of a factor when it comes to affecting where people live than ever before. Sure, people choose their home based on their family needs, but most of us choose our location based on work opportunities. Think about your own self. When you last moved, why was it? Odds are, you chose your house based on its proximity to your job. Once you knew the area you wanted to live in, you then started looking at other factors like how much house your money could get you, nearby school district scores, etc. There are many things that affect housing values and rental prices, but none more important than employment. Our jobs are a huge part of our life. We spent more time there than just about anywhere else. Consider also that the health of the employment sector can have a huge effect on your home's value. When wages in an area rise, home prices tend to as well. When jobs leave or wages fall, it can have the adverse effect. In almost every part of the country, real estate prices continually rise over time. The few exceptions to this rule are in areas where the job market fell into distress. Consider Detroit, Michigan, when the auto industry fell apart. As more demand, that word again, grew for foreign automakers, fewer cars were built in Detroit. This led to factories closing down, and with that, jobs disappearing. Large parts of Detroit became barren wastelands where the city was willing to literally give houses away for free to anyone that would pay the property taxes. How does an area become that destitute? Jobs. Lack of jobs will destroy an economy and with it, home values. Jobs are the lifeblood of an economy. Employers are the heart that pump blood to the people who live somewhere. Without that blood, the body dies. Housing is tied directly to jobs in a way that can't be erased until technology reaches a point where we can all work from home. I avoid investing in any area dependent on just one job market. Markets known for only having one industry, like oil fields, fishing, automobile manufacturing, etc., are all very vulnerable to a huge collapse in demand if something disrupts that, and a loss of demand will result in a lowering of value. Desirability. The next reason people choose where to live is the desirability of an area. This is why we often hear people talk about school districts, crime, and walkability scores. Things like proximity to parks, shopping, and nearby freeways all become a factor. Once you know where you will be working and settle on the city you want to live in, you'll usually start looking into secondary factors. If you have kids, school scores will be a determining factor. If you're religious, you'll want to know about churches. If you're elderly, the quality of the hospitals. If you like to be outdoors, you'll look for parks or walking trails. When choosing an area to invest in, you need to be looking at it with these same eyes. Are you buying somewhere that has a well-developed infrastructure? Did the City Planning Council make sure sufficient shopping and commercial areas were included in an area? Are there enough freeway on and off ramps to ensure a short commute? Buyers look at all these things, and so do tenants. If the city did a good job planning the development, demand is likely to grow over time. Affordability. Another huge factor people consider when moving is affordability. How much house can someone get for an area's median salary? If you live in a city where the median salary is $50,000 yearly, talk to a lender and find out how much the average person earning that salary can borrow. Once you have that number, let's say for this example it's $250,000, go online and look at what the average house looks like that's listed at $250,000. If the houses look updated and impressive, there isn't much incentive for someone to move any farther away. If the houses don't look updated or impressive, assume that buyers and tenants will start looking elsewhere. Look around the city and find which neighborhoods have really nice houses and at what price point they are. If you find a pocket where houses listed for $200,000 have beautiful upgrades, bigger yards, more space, etc., you just may have found the next market to appreciate. Understanding how buyers think is crucial to understanding how to determine market value. Understand that buyers drive markets. It is the demand to live in an area and then in a specific property that drives the price of the homes up or down. Tenants behave similarly to buyers, and rent prices behave similarly to home prices, though not exact. If home values are rising in an area due to strong demand, rents will usually follow suit. Finding these areas before other investors do gives you an advantage with building your wealth. Up-and-coming areas. Many people choose an area because of its reputation. If an area is considered up-and-coming, people will flock to it just to check it out. Think about markets like San Francisco. Young college graduates are willing to pay half their salary to live in a closet just so they can experience all San Francisco has to offer. Madison, Wisconsin is currently growing rapidly as young, bright minds move there to experience the city's growth. So is Austin, Texas. Why is this? When a city or area has a reputation as a growing hip place, people start looking for work there. Whereas, generally, people look for a job and then take the job they want in a city, some people will look for the city and then take any job they feel comfortable doing while there. As more people move in, more property taxes are collected, and the city can reinvest in its infrastructure. This leads to a growing, thriving area where demand increases faster than supply. Finding areas like this to invest in before prices run up can be a strong wealth builder. If you're going to use this strategy, be careful you don't wait and get in too late. If you hear a lot of people talking about how prices in an area have already risen, you may be too late for the party. The trick is to hear an area has a buzz and check to see if prices have risen yet. If they haven't, this may be an area to look into buying, renting, and selling a few years later. Climate. Another reason people choose an area is for the weather. Think about retirees. Don't you always hear they are moving to Florida or Arizona? Why these two states? They both have two things in common: weather and affordability. As a general rule, areas with more pleasant weather will be more attractive than those without. I've also found that in addition to demand rising in these areas, pleasant weather is also a benefit when it comes to maintaining your property. If it's not consistently raining or snowing on your roof, the roof will last longer. If you don't have to worry about shoveling snow in front of your apartment, you'll have one less expense. If you can avoid freezing pipes during a vacation or replacing boilers and furnaces constantly, your CapEx will be significantly lower and your NOI, net operating income, the profit your property generates, should be stronger. These are all factors that affect the demand of an area. Learning to find them and weigh them out before deciding will help you make better choices and see better returns. Remember, the key is to look at the market through the eyes of homebuyers. Knowing what they look for will give you an advantage in your business. Determining supply. On the other side of the coin from demand is supply. Supply in real estate is easier to regulate and control than demand. Whereas demand is a complex formula based on many of the variables I mentioned previously, supply is much simpler. When there are too many homes in an area, prices will drop. When there aren't enough homes, prices will increase. Because there is always someone looking to make money in real estate, there will always be opportunities to develop and build properties when there is insufficient supply to keep pace with demand. So, how do we determine the supply in a given area? Well, there are several factors to look at, and some will work better for certain areas than they will for others. I recommend using several of these strategies so you can get a clear overall picture of the health of an area before deciding to put your time, energy, and capital into investing there. DOM. First, ask a realtor for the average DOM, days on market, it takes houses to sell there. As a realtor myself, I can tell you this is an underrated way to gather intel on the pulse of a market, which investors don't look at often enough. Because most of us are investing for cash flow and passive income, we too often get sucked into the numbers on a spreadsheet and ignore other factors like DOM. Take my advice and learn to look at the whole picture so you can become a black belt investor. In a normal market, an average DOM is somewhere between 30 and 60 days. This is the period of time from when a property is listed to pending and into escrow. I define normal market as a market with a healthy amount of demand versus supply. At the time of the writing of this book, my market in the San Francisco Bay Area has an average DOM of less than 14 days for most homes. I often sell them in less than 3. When this becomes a pattern, it can start to feel like the new normal, and it becomes easy to see why many investors or homebuyers assume this will always be the case. Homes are selling so fast right now because hardly any new homes are being built. The supply has remained consistent while new jobs have come into the area, increasing demand. This lack of supply has led to a red-hot housing market, and low DOM is the metric that exemplifies that. If I'm going to look into buying in a market, a low DOM is an indication there could be a lack of supply. This can be a good thing for house prices, but might be a bad sign for buying. Low DOM is a sign you are likely to be facing more competition and need to write offers above asking price or with more lenient terms. One thing I can definitely tell you is if you are seeing signs that indicate a lack of sufficient supply, but you still have a high DOM, something isn't adding up and you should be digging deeper to find out why. Property manager turn times. Another technique is to ask a property manager for the average vacancy period between tenants for their overall landlords, often called a turn. It's not necessarily important we get the exact number of days, but we do want to know if it's a short period or a really long one. A good rule of thumb is more than 30 days isn't a great market to buy a rental. If you're finding properties are only vacant for a week or two, this can be a very encouraging sign. If I found properties were being rented out in 7 to 10 days from the time they were advertised, I would know it's not important if I fix them up substantially. A bare-bones rehab job would do the trick as far as getting the unit occupied. And if the ARV doesn't support a higher price point, I might severely limit my rehab budget. On the flip side, if properties were taking more than 30 days to find a tenant, I would consider a larger rehab to attract more people. Craigslist. Then, it's a great idea to get on Craigslist.org and email a landlord with a unit for rent. Ask them how many applications they've received for their rental unit or property. Ask them how long they have had the unit advertised for, and how long they expect it will be before it rents. As a general rule, if the landlord is dismissive of you and doesn't seem too engaged, they are probably getting lots of attention for the vacant unit. If they are extremely responsive and excited to hear from you, it might mean you are the first or one of the first people to inquire and they don't feel optimistic about getting many more inquiries. This can be a good way to gauge what a rental market is like when you are considering buying somewhere. And if you find the properties are renting out right away, it's a good bet your rents will be increasing by a healthy amount each year. Do this with several different Craigslist posts to get an overall picture of a rental market and target areas where you feel there is a lack of supply. Permit watch. In addition to this, you can call the City Planning Division and ask them how many permits they are planning to assign home builders. No new construction can take place in a city unless the city issues a permit for it to begin. These permits are like permission slips that allow home builders to build a property, for a fee, of course. Many cities limit the amount of permits they issue for new construction to avoid too much supply hitting the market at once and having properties sit vacant for too long. If you call the city and find out that they issue a limited number of permits that isn't keeping pace with supply, this is an indication you are more likely to see home values, and with them rent values, continue to increase year over year. If the city appears to be handing out permits like candy on Halloween, this is a sign you may want to avoid this market and focus on somewhere else with a more restricted supply chain. Property manager yearly rent increases. Next, ask a property manager how much their average rents are climbing with each lease renewal. If the unit isn't increasing much from year to year, that's a surefire sign that tenants have other options and will move if the rent goes up too much. What landlord won't raise their rent as much as they can when it won't hurt them to do so? Before you object, most of the landlords who don't raise the rents because the tenant is so great are managing their own properties, not using a PM. Of every technique I've listed so far, this one is my favorite. If rents are increasing by a healthy amount, 5 to 10% or higher in most areas, this is a very good sign. In fact, if rents are increasing by this much, it's almost guaranteed there is a lack of supply. Here's why. Tenants will never want to pay more than they absolutely must to live in a property. While some people do choose to rent, the vast majority of tenants are renting because they have to. For those that are renting a property, there will never come a time when they cheerfully and happily pay more than they need to. Most tenants will take the cheaper option, wherever it is, as long as it's a similar property. If rents are increasing every year, it's not because tenants are unaware they could pay less somewhere else. It's because there is no other option that is cheaper. If there are no cheaper options, that's a strong sign there is a lack of supply, which is a good sign for your business. Downtown construction. Another huge indicator of a lack of supply is when you see big construction equipment in the skyline when driving through the downtown of an area, if you have one. If you're looking into investing in a city with a downtown area, you want to know if the lack of supply you think you're seeing is specific to the downtown area, the suburbs, or both. If you see a lot of new home construction going on in the suburbs, but not a lot of downtown construction, you should ask why. It could be that a nearby city is thriving and people are commuting from your city to that one. It could also be that the average population of the city is getting older and the young professionals are leaving the downtown area to buy bigger homes and raise families. This might actually be a bad sign and could be an indication that the supply isn't the problem, but the type of property is. If that's the case, you wouldn't want to be investing in a multifamily property downtown when the majority of the population is moving away from that area. If you see lots of construction taking place in a downtown area, it's almost always a strong sign there is lack of supply. New construction is expensive. There's no way around it. It's usually cheaper to buy something used and fix it up than to build brand new. If companies are shelling out big dollars to pay for materials, permits, salaries, and equipment rental, it's usually because there is no other option. The existing inventory is lacking, and they are forced to pay top dollar to build new properties, a sign of lack of supply. Real estate agent intel. You should ask top producing real estate agents in the area how many new homes are being built. New home builds are an easy way to know there is limited supply, as most new home builders are very careful they don't overbuild and only build when there is a very strong demand with insufficient supply. If you find there are several new home builders all building in an area, this is usually good news, but we don't want to assume. When I find this to be the case, I call the home builder and I ask their sales team how many homes they are building a month and how fast they are selling. In some small cases, I've found the builder got a great deal on land or the city is incentivizing them to build, and the lack of supply isn't necessarily the reason why they are building. One conversation with a sales agent of a new home builder can answer a lot of these questions and help you understand how to interpret the information. You should also be aware of what surrounding homes offer in terms of amenities. Research your competition. The first question we want to ask before moving forward is, what amenities do other properties have near mine? The principle is the same as fixing your property up to look like surrounding homes when you're flipping it. We want to make sure other rental properties don't have amenities we are missing. Otherwise, we might miss out on tenants. To start this off, I get my property manager involved in the rehab of my units. I want to show them what I'm planning on doing and what materials I'm planning on using so they can let me know if I'm doing too much or not doing enough. PMs actively rent properties out every day, so they know what my competition is doing much better than I do. It's faster and better to ask them than to try to go learn it all for myself. Once I know what materials or finishes nearby properties have, I then ask the PM what features tenants are typically requesting the most. Do they want space in the side yard for extra storage? Are they looking for an outdoor patio? Do they mind carpet, or are they specifically asking to see homes with only laminate or tile? How important are stainless steel appliances? If I know what tenants want, I can reverse engineer my rehab to make sure these are the materials I use in my rehab. Using better materials. Keep in mind that if we are to BRRRR the property, we can usually get away with a nicer rehab and still recoup more of our capital. This gives us the luxury of using better materials than the traditional model would, but not losing too much capital. When we end up with a nicer remodel than our competition, it helps us in several ways. For one, it cuts down on vacancies. As I've mentioned before, tenants behave similarly to buyers. This means they go online and look at pictures of homes before going to see them. If your property looks better in the pictures because you used better materials, this can cut down on your vacancy rate significantly. This is especially important when the vacancy periods or turn times are higher than 30 days. If you can cut down on 30 days of vacancy, that can save you anywhere from $500 to $1,500 in most cases. If you can do this for 3 turns in a row, that's big money and can pay for some of these upgrades on its own. Buying in the path of progress. The path of progress is a term used to describe the direction of growth. If you look at the way cities and markets expand, there is a pattern to it. When you recognize the pattern, you can anticipate what's likely to happen in the future. When you can do that, you can make moves that put yourself in the position to capitalize on future growth, increased rents, and appreciating values. Learning the pieces that make up this pattern is one of the elements you need to master if you want to become a black belt investor. Buying in the path of progress allows you to pay less when you buy, wait, then see appreciation. It is one of the tricks for buy low, sell high. Most of the BRRRR process is about forced appreciation. This is appreciation we created through buying right, wise renovations, and a shrewd understanding of numbers. While forced appreciation is usually a safer bet because you control it, you'd have to be a fool to just ignore market appreciation as well. Market appreciation should always be looked at like icing on the cake. Your BRRRR process is the actual cake. But if you already have a cake, why not go for icing too? If you can buy a home in the path of progress and BRRRR it, why wouldn't you? The idea is simple. You look for the direction you believe housing values are likely to rise. You buy there, and you wait. Just like supply and demand, the path of progress is determined by buyers. If you want to understand real estate, start by understanding the psychology of buyers. Below are some of the ways you can recognize when an area is about to turn for the better. When you see these signs, you'll know the path of progress has made its way to you. Learning to recognize these signs will help you to determine the path of progress. Finding these areas before the rest of the market does is a great hack to get more icing on your cake. Buyer Bob's story. Because real estate is so lending-based, you must learn to start with what a buyer or tenant will be paying per month and work backward from there. Let's start with Bob. Bob recently got a new job at a city waste facility in the heart of Smallville. He's paid an average salary for someone working in Smallville. Bob is excited to finally buy a home and gets pre-approved with a lender. The lender determines that based on Bob's debt-to-income ratio, Bob can afford to pay $1,500 per month. This means Bob can buy a house for, say, $200,000. Did Bob know he wanted to pay $200,000? Nope. The lender told him that's what he could pay, so that set Bob's expectation. Bob finds a real estate agent and asks to see homes listed at $200,000 and under. The agent sets Bob up on a drip campaign that notifies Bob when new listings in this price range hit the market. Bob checks his email daily and asks to see homes he likes. When he finds one he likes, Bob makes an offer, gets accepted, closes escrow, and becomes a homeowner. Congrats, Bob! This is how the vast majority of buyers in America buy homes. But what would have happened if Bob didn't see anything he liked for $200,000 or less? Well, Bob would have had a few options. 1. Save up more money, get a promotion, and get approved for the house he really wants. 2. Rent an apartment or live with a family member or friend. 3. Adjust his expectations and buy something he does not like as much to live in for now and start saving to buy his dream home later. 4. Start looking farther away to find an area where nicer houses cost less and keep looking until he finds houses he will like for $200,000 in his target area. Which of these options do you think the average American is most likely to choose? Sure, there are a few people with the self-discipline to delay gratification and save money to buy a house they love. There are even fewer willing to buy something they don't like to invest for the future. But the vast majority of Americans will move farther away from their ideal location to find a house they love. Remember, a lot of people make decisions based on emotion, and the home we buy affects our emotional state. Don't underestimate this just because you're an investor and tend to look at numbers more. Most people don't. So, what is buyer Bob most likely to do? He's going to ask his agent to include cities farther away until he finds one where he can get the homes he likes for $200,000. If the city isn't unreasonably far from his work, he'll buy there and find a way to adjust his life around the home purchase. He may trade in his Chevy Camaro for a used Honda Civic, cut down on eating out, and start working a little overtime, but he'll make the adjustments he needs to get the house he wanted. If we understand this is how most buyers think and act, it becomes very logical that we should try to anticipate where they will be moving. Buyer Bob's journey detailed the path of progress for Smallville. Central Smallville was too expensive for the average blue-collar worker, so these workers started moving away until they found the area they could afford to be in. The direction these buyers moved in is the path of progress. Looking back, it's easy to see why an area appreciated in value. Bob's story is an example of how this works. Values spread when the central location reaches a point where it becomes unaffordable for the majority of buyers. This then pushes the buyers slowly outward in a circle toward neighboring cities or areas. This circle expands outward unless it hits some form of barrier, in which case the buyers are redirected. A case study of San Francisco. At the time of writing this book, the city of San Francisco is experiencing a growth surge like I have never seen. Property values are absolutely exploding to unrealistic levels. In 2018 alone, the median home price has risen by $205,000. With this, rents have climbed so high that people making six figures a year have to share one-bedroom apartments just to afford to live. If you bought a property in San Francisco a year or two ago, you'd probably already have made six figures in equity. The growth has been staggering. San Francisco is an extreme example of what can happen to an area's property values in a few short years. This tsunami of demand causes values to explode when the supply is limited. Learning from San Francisco can help us when it starts happening in other areas so we can be prepared to act. As San Francisco became insanely expensive, buyers and tenants were pushed outward into the greater Bay Area. This led to home prices rising steadily farther and farther away. As these homes became too expensive for the average worker to afford, they were pushed farther and farther away. San Francisco became the epicenter of a massive rise in home and rent prices, creating an affordability crisis in the Bay Area. If you saw this coming and bought early, you made lots and lots of money. The path of progress was logical and predictable, therefore repeatable. Learn to recognize when you see similar signs in the area you invest, then take action accordingly. Geographic and economic barriers. As San Francisco became too expensive, buyers could not head south because that led them right to Silicon Valley, where the tech industry is headquartered. Big, successful mega companies like Apple and Google have their headquarters there, and home prices were already higher than San Francisco's. Because going south wasn't an option, buyers couldn't move that direction, and the path of progress did not follow that route. West was not an option because of a geographic barrier, namely the ocean. That left east and north as the only available ways for the path of progress to take. If we start looking north, that leads us into Marin County. This is an area with expensive homes owned by typically wealthy people. This is also the direction of Napa Valley, where some of the best winemakers in the world get their grapes. This was not a feasible direction for the path of progress because it was already too expensive, much like heading south. This led to many homebuyers moving northeast into Sonoma County and east into Alameda, Contra Costa, and San Joaquin counties. Sonoma County saw a boom in demand as buyers flooded the area. Even though the commute was an hour or more in some places, buyers were still willing to make the drive because wages were so high in San Francisco. See the next segment, Economic Growth, for more info on that. As houses started selling over asking price with multiple offers, comparable sales continued to rise, allowing appraisers to give home sales higher values. This led to increased rents as more and more people chose to sell their rentals and cash in on the higher values. With fewer available properties to rent and rising rents, landlords came out way ahead. After enough of this, home builders moved into the area and started building tons of homes. At this point, many home builders are moving into this area to meet the rising demand and lack of supply. If you bought before any of this happened, you found your property growing in value quickly. The path of progress also found its way east, most notably to the city of Oakland. Oakland is the first market buyers would come to heading east from San Francisco. It's also a city nationally recognized for being one of the most dangerous, crime-riddled cities in the country. In spite of this fact, Oakland property values increased at a crazy rate as more and more buyers moved there. Why? Even though most buyers in a normal market would want nothing to do with Oakland, many found a way to make it work once they realized they simply could not afford to live in San Francisco and didn't want a lengthy commute. This led to a gentrification of the area as more executive-level business people moved in. Currently, the entire city is experiencing a revitalization in some parts, and home prices are higher than they've ever been. This has all been as a result of the path of progress moving this way first. As the path of progress spilled over Oakland, the surrounding cities all went up in value too. Cities known for being dangerous or high crime had more and more buyers moving in because they didn't have any other options. Cities considered to be too far away rose in value as buyers had no option but to commute. The local transit system, BART, was extended to help commuters take the train from Contra Costa County into downtown San Francisco. Entire market centers changed to support the path of progress. One friend of mine, Derek, bought a rental property at an auction in one of these crime-riddled cities and made it a rental. Derek recognized the path of progress was making its way into this city and also knew about the public transit that was being extended there. Even though Derek went through several evictions and lengthy repairs from tenant damage, He still made tens of thousands of dollars when he sold the property a few years later. This is a prime example of how buying in the path of progress can lead to big results even when everything else is going wrong. Economic growth. Economic growth is what drives the path of progress to happen in most cases. As jobs move into an area, people follow. If more people move into an area than there are units to house them, prices will slowly rise. If the jobs that move in offer much higher wages than existed before, prices can rise at a much faster rate. If the home buyers make high wages and can qualify for more money than the house costs, they will make an offer over asking price to be the winning bidder. When homes start selling way over asking price, housing values start rising fast. This happened in San Francisco because of the tech industry. Many technology startups and successful tech companies moved into the area because of its desirable location and amenities. These companies, many of them funded by venture capitalists dumping loads of money into unproven startups, were able to pay wages much higher than the area was used to seeing for employees much less experienced and skilled than the traditional San Francisco employee. This led to many college grads making over six figures at their first job. Because they all needed to move to San Francisco for work, rental units were snatched up and there wasn't much room left for anyone else. This drove up rent prices, and with that, increased NOI for investment properties. With that, new construction started to take place in the city as more buildings were erected and higher rent was charged. Remember that growing demand and lack of supply is the same moment when you start to see construction equipment downtown. This is everywhere in San Francisco. Look to the skyline and you're guaranteed to see a crane somewhere. Nice restaurants. When the path of progress has made its way to an area, but before values have already peaked, there are several warning signs things are starting to turn. One of the first warning signs an area is beginning to turn is when what used to be dive bars, liquor stores, and cheap restaurants are starting to turn into upscale establishments with upgraded decor and impressive menus. Restaurants don't turn before an area turns. Business owners do serious due diligence before they make the decision to open a new location and invest that much capital. If fancy restaurants, or at least not dives, start opening up, it's a very strong indication things are starting to improve. In San Francisco, many of the old diners that hadn't been upgraded in decades were bought by newer establishments and immediately flipped. Talking to locals and asking about what's new and being talked about is a great way to find out if there are new restaurants being opened. A good chance a neighborhood is turning. The "Can you believe that house sold for that much?" talk. When an area is beginning to turn, this is one of the first things you will hear everyone saying. For those who